listening to Diabetes Exposed, the not-so-terrible truth. And I'm your host, a tad diabetic blogger, Tad Roberts. The mission of this show is to dispel myths and false preconceptions and to find excellence in diabetes self-management by fighting the troubling trend of low expectations. We can achieve our dreams, even with the burden of diabetes and the masses who say we can't. I know, because I've done it, and every single day I find more and more diabetics who have found the secrets to good control and a beautiful life despite the presence of an incurable condition. I want to help you tap into strategies that will lead to your own success and help you see the power of your own self-efficacy. But it all starts with first steps, and the step you're taking now just might change the way you see everything.
Please note that this show is not meant to be medical advice or a substitute for medical advice. No changes should be made to your diabetes self-management without first consulting a doctor.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the show. Today I've got a great topic lined up and an amazing interview for this episode's Diabetes Success Story segment. This episode is titled War of the Diabetes Worlds or A Celebration of Diversity, with the concern being that we have too much of the former and not enough of the latter. So let's get started. Okay, my youngest daughter, Skye, she hates spinach. I absolutely love it. Skye loves raw carrots. I can't stand them. Cooked are okay though. My oldest son, Michael, is a very outgoing extrovert, while my second oldest son, Brendan, is intensely introverted. We have to pry his mouth open and force him to emit sounds during dinnertime conversations. Despite our very tight genetic bonds, we have these varying experiences, preferences, and personalities. It's our individuality. If the nearly 8 billion people on our planet were all identical clones, like something from a science fiction movie, then our human experience would almost certainly be really boring and painfully predictable. There's an old saying that variety is the spice of life, and I couldn't agree more. Drawn from William Cowper's 1785 poem, The Task, that specifically worded sentiment has served to celebrate diversity for more than two centuries. Today, with our population so high and social media becoming a primary source for connecting that staggering number of diverse opinions and personalities, the internet has become a bit of a battlefield for espousing one's particular view of the cosmos. With a seething cauldron of arguments on politics, movies, cable TV shows, celebrities, and weight loss methods boiling around the cybersphere, it's no wonder that some pretty divisive debates have crept their way into the diabetes online community. Part of this exists because we know so much about diabetes self-management today, and our dietary, pharmacological, and technological options are many and growing. When I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes 25 years ago, you could practically enumerate the entire span of diabetes self-management options with one short sentence. Now we have a variety of human insulins, analog insulins, glucose meters, CGMs, pumps, and emerging technologies such as looping and islet cell transplantation. Then there's the dispute over daily therapy management strategies. Do I go pump or MDI? And lest we forget the most divisive of them all, dietary strategies. Ranging from ketogenic diets and low carb to I'm going to count my carbs and eat all that I want, we're witnessing a full-scale war of the diabetes worlds. Can you imagine what an intriguing novel War of the Worlds would have been if H.G. Wells had written it today and in with the context of diabetes? It'd probably go something like this. The invading Martians would likely be replaced with some advanced alien virus hybrids that enter the human bloodstream and trigger an autoimmune reaction in humans, causing them to destroy their own pancreases and develop diabetes. But despite their technological superiority, the alien virus hybrids succumb to their own overconfidence and hubris as the human immune systems destroy them as well. In the end, the human race survives, but is left with an indelible mark and reminder of their own overconfidence in the form of diabetes mellitus. Ultimately, the theme of human complacency that sits at the core of Wells' War of the Worlds would still play itself out, leaving the reader haunted with the questions of what military or biological defense could have been established to prevent such a tragic invasion. Well, I guess it might be something like that, but fortunately, in the modern War of the Diabetes Worlds, the warring parties aren't so insidious or ill-prepared. They're just a group of souls who have different tastes, preferences, and tolerances, and each has been shaped differently through their own personal experiences with diabetes. But despite our differences, I believe we share far more similarities. We all got dealt a hand we didn't want and didn't ask for. We're all forced to stay attentive to our condition around the clock, 365 days a year. We all reach a point sometimes where the constant monitoring starts to wear on us. And I think that deep down, we all simply yearn for a normal life where we're free to pursue our passions and our dreams without biological interference. That normal life was what I desperately wanted when I was diagnosed. I didn't want to be different, be looked at differently, live differently, or have anything compel me to manage some screwy health condition. That normal life was what I wanted, and I became determined to have it. My quest for normal started with exercise to help control my diabetes. After becoming familiar with the various effects of exercise on my blood sugar levels, I moved on to an intense study of the effects of food on my blood sugars. Although I only had regular and NPH human insulins and a blood glucose meter, I dedicated myself to learning how these assets could be used to keep my levels in the preferred 80 to 120 milligram per deciliter range. I was always looking for cause and effect relationships and trying to chart patterns. Everything hinged on cause and effect relationships. I told myself that every effect had a cause and that the cause was something I had to understand for success to be possible. I really got crazy with the analysis, but each new pattern identified and each new lesson learned put more control in my hands, and my confidence and my overall happiness seemed to grow proportionately. Although I couldn't avoid having to manage a screwy health condition, I now have my version of normal, and it's pretty darn sweet. And that is why I get crazy, jump up and down, shout from the rooftops excited when I hear of new technologies, therapies, diets, and insights on exercise for diabetics. If someone online is passionately relating how their particular diet has helped them find success, I try to learn everything I can about how that diet impacted their diabetes self-management. I may never find the need to incorporate that strategy into my own diabetes self-management, but knowing about it is an important point of reference and another tool in my diabetes toolbox. Knowledge is power, and options are a tremendous comfort with the challenges that diabetes throws at us. So why are we spending so much time bickering when we should be applauding our collective diversity, our technological advancements, and the amazing modern era of diabetes self-management? Well, the answer to that question lies in good old human nature. It's a problem of passion gone awry. We believe deeply in our methods, and we often assume that what works for us will necessarily work for others. In a more technical sense, that probably holds a lot of truth, but again, we're not clones. Our individuality, psychological makeup, and our needs get in the way. Ultimately, success is a very personal thing and relative to each diabetic's goals and their particular vision of the future. We have to be sensitive to that. I like to think of the internet as a vast and open cafeteria of diabetes self-management strategies. We can stroll down the line as often as we like and choose what whets our appetite. If we get tired of our favorite chicken fried steak, we can always give the liver and onions a try. Well, that is if you dig liver and onions. Ugh. Anyway, over the past 2 years, I have made a ton of new diabetic friends and acquaintances through my blogging and book writing efforts. One of my most cherished friendships is fellow type 1, Vicki McWaters. Vicki's the developmental manager for the JDRF Arizona chapter, and she is my go-to for no-nonsense, honest, and straightforward opinions. I first met Vicki when she volunteered to be a test reader for my upcoming book, The Gift of Diabetes. When the idea for this blog post started bouncing around inside my head, I immediately thought of Vicki. Why, you may ask? Well, it's because we're two diabetics who have found two completely different paths to diabetes self-management success. We're different in strategy, but we're the same in our commitment to control. Vicky was diagnosed 20 years ago, and she's been on a pump since day one. I, as you know, was diagnosed 25 years ago and have always been MDI. Vicky sticks to a very low-carb diet. I watch my carb intake. That is, I watch the carbs as they enter my mouth, but I certainly wouldn't consider myself a low-carb guy. Well, regardless of our differing methods, we've both been able to find our definition of success and a confidence in our diabetes self-management. And at the end of the day, isn't that the point? It doesn't matter how we get there, as long as the destination is reached. But there's another, equally important reason why I chose to tell Vicky's story. Her story starts off like so many that I read in emails and online, but her conclusion is encouragingly different. Vicky McWaters didn't always feel the level of confidence that she does today. But you know what? Forget it. I'm going to stop right there. I'm not going to tell any more of Vicky's story. I'm going to let Vicky tell you herself, because she's this week's diabetes success story, and she's here. Well, she's on the line. Well, I think she's on the line. Hey, Vicky, are you there?
I am. Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. And how are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Great. I am so happy to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing part of your story. I've already given the audience a little bit of a background on you. They know that you've been type 1 for 20 years. They know that you're on a pump and that you go the low-carb route. They also know that you've reached a point where you feel successful with your diabetes self-management. I just mentioned, though, that you didn't always feel so confident in your diabetes self-management. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like when you didn't feel good about your diabetes self-management? What was different?
Yeah, of course. And I will just make a little note here that feeling successful is day by day, because there are still challenging days, of course. But, you know, Kat, I think it was just, I found that winning combination, and it took me a while to find it. The very first thing I absolutely had to do was change my mindset and be open to new ideas and trying something different. And by doing that, I tried some things that didn't work so well and some other things that seemed to be working. And right now I feel like I have better management currently than I've ever had in my 20 years. And it's by doing things completely different than the way that I was taught.
Tell me a little bit about that. How were you taught in the beginning?
You know, I think you're typical. Here's a vial, here's a needle, and count your carbs and watch your sugar and whatever that means. And it was challenging. I didn't have the textbook, but I felt like everything I was doing was textbook, what the doctor was telling me. I would wait my 3 months and I would go back to the doctor and I'd have a high A1C, and I would sit in his office and cry and say, I just don't think I can do this. I don't know what I'm doing. And he would send me to a CDE, a certified nurse educator, and we would sit and we'd go over a meal plan and we would count carbs, and, you know, and it was this cycle, which I'm sure many people have gone through, and I just couldn't make it work for me. So I got really frustrated, and I got so frustrated, I got to the point where I just kind of turned my hands up and said, I'm not going to not take insulin. I'm not going to hurt myself, but I just pretended like I didn't have it. I wore an insulin pump. I had a basal rate in the background. I would bolus every once in a while, but I didn't really shoot for being as healthy as I could. And over the course of that time, I tried low carb many times, and it did work better for me. But I think it was a combination, at least for me, of doing the low carb thing, because I do really feel like that helped me. And quite honestly, I feel like it is a little bit of lazy type 1 management, because it does make things a lot easier. But also the freedom of, I finally let myself stop counting carbs. I was able to stop counting carbs by using my Dexcom, watching my Dexcom, creating my low range and my high range really tight. So my Dexcom is set, the low is 70 and the high is 120. And while I don't beat myself up if I creep up to 120, 125, 130, but when I start seeing it rise, I can act immediately and I can get it back down. Because what I found, I wear an insulin pump, as you said, and there are definitely times that I may put that new pump on and I may hit some scar tissue and it just doesn't absorb properly and the pump is not working that well for me. If I let my blood sugar get up over 200 right now, now granted, this has not always been the case because I spent many a time over 200 all the time, but now if I get up over 200, it takes that much more insulin to get me back down in range where I want to be. So it's a really vicious cycle, Tad.
Yes, indeed.
That struggle is real, and it does get discouraging, but there's a lot of things that come into play as to why certain things happen. There's always cause and effect, right? There's if you let that blood sugar get up too high, and I see this all the time with parents who have young kids. They complain that they're giving insulin and they just can't get it down. They just can't get it down. And I'm no doctor, but I assume that there's a little bit of insulin resistance once it gets up higher and you need more insulin. So it just gets so frustrating. It just, you feel like you're defeated. You feel like this is a pass or fail. And I had to also take that mindset out of my head and say, this isn't a pass or fail. This is, everything is just a learning opportunity. And it's hard. I still get frustrated with myself, but tomorrow's a new day and, you know, you get it back to where you need it. And I have more good days than I have bad days.
You know, how we perceive and internalize those bad days, I think it's a major key to our success and our happiness. If we don't look at them as teaching moments, you know, as learning opportunities, then that's when we let ourselves down. And worse, I think it allows us to fall into a trap of seeing that off day as a personal failure. Now, you said something about cause and effect, and that's such an important way of shaping our perspective of what's going on. It's something that when I first got to that point where I'd made up my mind that I was going to figure this out, that I was going to make it work for me, the basic premise I started with was that every effect that was happening in our bodies with diabetes, there was a cause for it. And I had to know those causes. I had to learn all of these causes. Because once I knew the causes, once I'd identified them, then I could do something about them and I could take the steps necessary to bring my blood sugars under control. Approaching it from that perspective is one of the big things I owe to my success. But of course, to understand those causes, that gets to the most important thing, is the education factor. Mm-hmm. That to understand those causes for our blood sugar levels, we've got to be educated properly to understand everything from, you know, dawn phenomenons to different effects, you know, blood sugar rebounds off lows, all these different things, to know why it's happening. If we know that why, it makes it so much easier. No, it's never going to be easy, but it gets to a point to where we can kind of find an autopilot, you know, and start spending more time, I think, enjoying and living our lives. And I think that sounds to me like that's a lot of what you found, although you know we all still have our odd days. Yeah.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think too there's so many things that even the people that we go to for answers don't really know, and we're all so different. Things affect us all so differently. I never knew how much protein affected my blood sugar until I cut out the carbohydrates. Now, in saying that, it could be that when I'm eating a lot of carbohydrates, protein doesn't have as big of an effect because my body is not turning that protein into glucose. So I may just now be in a new situation where I do have to bolus for protein because of the lack of carbs. But I have also heard other type 1s who do eat carbs to say they also bolus for protein. I don't know about you, Cad, but I was never taught that when I was first diagnosed. So for that even to be a possibility, that could be a huge factor into why when I was quote-unquote carb counting, it didn't work for me. Because maybe I did need a little extra for that protein. There's just so many factors.
Yeah, there are.
There's usually always a reason, but it's figuring those reasons out and then being able to manage those reasons.
No, it's interesting you say that because I do bolus for protein. Typically, since I'm MDI, I'll take my Novolog or Humalog for the carbs, and then for the protein, typically that's where I use regular insulin because it's going to peak about two and a half hours later, or about an hour and a half later than the Novolog does. So it seems to kick in right about the time that protein starts converting, and usually I don't need a lot. And it depends on what the protein is, too. But if it's something like eggs or just, even lean ground beef or chicken, something like that, I take a very small amount of it, but it seems to help take me right through that point, and it works pretty well.
Yeah, so that's where my insulin pump comes in handy because I can do a dual bolus. So I could give a little bit up front, and then over time I can give the rest.
Right.
So it's exactly what you're kind of doing with the regular insulin. So then do you take long-acting as well? So do you take three different insulin types?
I do, but I take NPH, believe it or not. I'm still one of the people that uses that. But I only take that at night. That's my nighttime to get me through my dawn phenomenon. But during the regular day, I don't take any basal insulin, believe it or not. I kind of have – I've learned how to build that into everything. And because I'm also so active and because I work out a lot, I tend to burn a lot of sugar just naturally throughout the day. So I don't take typically an actual basal insulin or long term. It all seems to work its way out, which I think also points to the whole thing that I talk about so much is that since each of us are so different, we all kind of have to figure out, our own path to success, what works for us.
Yeah, that was a great example of you figured out what works for you, and I know it seems to be working, and I feel like I'm still figuring things out, of course, but I learn every day, I learn something new every day, but it does take that, you just have to take ownership of it, and all of us, I think, that live with type 1 understand our bodies a lot more than maybe your average person that doesn't have a chronic illness. But then just taking that a little step further and experimenting. I think that's basically what I've done to figure it out. And it sounds like that's kind of what you've done as well.
Yeah. And the experimentation is everything. And that's how I started my whole process of this self-discovery and learning how to manage it. It was literally just charting graphs and writing details in a notebook every day, trying to find, again, those cause and effect relationships, between quantities of food I ate, particular types of food I ate, relative then to how much insulin I was taking, and all this just to make it all make some sense. But it was amazing over the years, eventually, things that would just seem so nebulous and so hard to figure out and hard to grasp, they started to make sense. But
yeah, and see, I'm more of the technology girl where I like to use my Dexcom and my Dexcom reports. I don't want to bother with writing it down.
I know I'm an old school guy all the way. Someday I'm gonna jump on board and I'm gonna go the CGM route and the pump route, but for now, I don't know. It's just, it's almost like I'm afraid to try anything different because I've got a system that works, and leaving it right now, it scares the heck out of me, the thought of even attempting or even contemplating something else.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to switch topics for a moment to your work with JDRF. Now, for anyone out there who doesn't know, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation has been an instrumental force since 1970 in funding research for a cure for type 1 diabetes and helping type 1 diabetics adapt to the stresses of self-management. The goal is to help type 1s live better quality lives until a cure is found. It's a truly amazing organization. So, Vicki, how long have you been with JDRF, and what's your primary role there?
So I started actually working for JDRF about 2.5 years ago, but I did start volunteering pretty much right after I was diagnosed 20 years ago. I was living in a different state then. But I did find all of that you just said, in addition to just the camaraderie. To me, that meant so much to me as an adult being diagnosed, because I wasn't diagnosed until I was 30 years old. Being an adult, I never had a caregiver, and I never had anyone that really understood what I was going through. So to meet other people, and JDRF gave me that opportunity, I started volunteering for them, and now working for them, it's kind of like a dream job. I am responsible for our walk here in Phoenix every year, and I also do a walk in Tucson, which is a smaller walk. Our walk in Phoenix has about 15,000 people that attend. And the first time I went to the Phoenix walk, I was just blown away, because all of those people, all of those 15,000 people there, were there because of type 1 and because they want to make the lives of everyone with type 1 better. Ultimately, a cure. But in the meantime, you know, we're also looking for prevention. What causes it? Why did I get this at 30? Why did you get it at, you were in your 20s, right?
Right, 24, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, we've got kids in our community that were 2 and, you know, and all ages. And why do we have multiple kids in families? We have a family of 4 kids, and 3 of the 4 kids have type 1. You know, so why? What is causing this? So, for me, I'm very passionate about prevention, and then JDRF is also very involved in treatment and, you know, things like our CGMs and our pumps and new insulins that are coming out. It's all because JDRF helps fund that type of research.
Yeah, I think one of the things, too, that's always impressed me is your outreach, for type 1s, because one of the things, and this is, I've been a little vocal about online negativity and so much of that kind of stuff. And the reason I'm so passionate about that and why that concerns me so much is because I remember when I was diagnosed, I was in this just awful place. I mean, I was so depressed. I thought that there was really no future for me. My life had ended, you know, and there was just nothing good ever to happen in my future. My life was done. And I felt so bad for so long. And the thing was, and I think about that state that I'm in, and I know that there are so many other diabetics out there every day that are sitting there in that same place, and they're having those same concerns, and they're afraid, and they need someone to turn to and someone to go to help get them pointed in the right direction and give them some hope. And that's what it seems like your outreach program is so great at, is that you have all of these resources out there, even from your website, and then between the website and then the individual people that you have connected to you, you're this beautiful little network of support out there. And that's just something to me that I don't know. I just think it's an amazing thing.
Yeah, I do too, Tad. I, when I started 2.5 years ago here in Phoenix, one of the things I was really passionate about doing that wasn't really in my job description, but I thought this needs to be done, is I started an adult group. So we have a group of type 1 adults, and we get together once a month. Sometimes I bring in like an educational speaker. Sometimes we just go to happy hour and just sit around and talk. And when our food comes, we all get our pumps out or our insulin out and dose ourselves, which is kind of fun. And I have had people say that they have never known another type 1 diabetic, and just the opportunity to get together and realize that people are going through the same type of stuff. I agree. I think it can be so lonely, and mental health is a big part of this disease. So whatever we can do to help that is so rewarding to me. It's my favorite part of the job. So I love the outreach piece.
Yeah. Well, I can see too how, yeah, being in that environment could be so positive and so encouraging. Well, what's on the horizon for JDRF right now? Is there any exciting news to report? I know there's some stuff that I had read recently on artificial pancreases. That's obviously the new emerging technology, but anything big?
We don't have a lot of research here in Arizona, but it just so happens that at the University of Arizona, which is in Tucson, we have a scientist that's working on encapsulation. And I actually got the opportunity to go down and tour the lab and learn about it a little bit more. And it is very exciting. You know, it's not in clinical trials yet. It's not in human trials yet. But JDRF has given this particular lab a pretty good grant for them to continue their work and to ultimately get it in human trials. But it is a little device that goes under your skin, and the beta cells are put in there, so they're protected with this material so that your body's immune system can't attack those beta cells.
Right.
But the material is enough that you can, your like veins can grow into it so that they can start taking those beta cells and producing insulin. And they've been pretty successful in some of the trials that they've had so far. So that's very exciting. And potentially that could last up to 5 years, and then you would be completely insulin independent. And then you go back 5 years and get a new one. And I think I could handle that. You know, I mean, just make a doctor's appointment every 5 years.
Wow, yeah, absolutely.
No immunosuppressant drugs. That's what they're going towards. Because that's the big thing about beta cell replacement is right now you still have to take the immunosuppressant drugs, which have a lot
right.
of effects on its own. So, yeah, a lot of exciting things. A lot of exciting things with technology, like you said, the artificial pancreas, where they're actually working on an insulin pump that would have glucagon as well as insulin so that it would correct the lows or correct when you're getting low, just like your pancreas and your liver kind of talk to one another and make that decision in a healthy body.
Right.
That would be done all within an insulin pump. So real exciting stuff.
Wow. Yeah. It's so amazing. I mean, how far things are coming at right now.
You know, I honestly don't know, Tad, if there will ever be a cure in our lifetime. I do believe that it's tricky when you don't know what causes something and, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes really hard to kind of cure it. But I do think that in our lifetime, we will see a cure-like treatment that will allow us to go back to eat whatever we want, whenever we want to, and not have to worry about our blood sugars.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and as long as we can find a way through something like, I've always loved the whole idea of the encapsulation of the beta cells. That just, that to mm-hmm. me has always seemed to be the one. If they could get that one to work, it seems that, you know, an easy implant, you know, and the whole process just is less invasive than some other ones.
Yeah.
I've always said, because I remember they were even talking about that way back when I was diagnosed, you know, shortly thereafter, and oh gosh, all kinds yeah. of stuff about sending monkeys into space and doing tests and all that. And I always thought, yeah, it was something that really, really intrigued me. I thought, wow, they've got to get that one fixed. So, and to see that we're getting closer and closer to that now, that's exciting. So yeah, I agree with you. Finding a cure for it, because it is such an oddly mysterious autoimmune condition, it's probably not going to happen. But if they can find a way to do what the pancreas does, then essentially that's, to me, that's as good as a cure. So, because
right.
then you think about this, when somebody gets diagnosed, then wow, instead of having to go through years of trial and error and figuring things out like you and I had to do,
right.
I guess they go down, get a set of islet cells injected, and boom, they're back in business. So.
Right.
I am praying for that day.
Yeah.
Me too. Well, I've got a couple of fun questions for you here, okay? All right.
Okay.
What is your favorite diabetes-friendly food? Okay, this is the one that, you know, you eat pretty regularly because you really like it and you know exactly how it affects your blood glucose levels.
Well, that's an easy one. Avocados.
Avocados.
I love my avocados. Yeah.
Do you just eat them plain, or you turn it into guacamole?
Yeah, either way. I can eat. I'll take one for lunch every once in a while, and I'll just eat that for lunch. I love them.
Right. How do they affect your blood sugar?
You know, I mean, it obviously depends on what I eat with them. If I'm eating, like, eggs or something for breakfast, I will have to bolus a little bit. But usually, just an avocado, I don't even have to bolus.
I was going to say, yeah, when I've eaten it in the past, you know, avocado dips and stuff like that, it's been a pretty minimal effect on my blood sugar. So, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Question two, then. What is your favorite food that's not necessarily diabetes friendly? You know, but the kind that you would have maybe on, oh, let's say, special occasions.
That one's a little tougher. I don't feel like I'm deprived of anything, even eating low carb. So I do want to say that. If I want something sweet, I use sweeteners that don't affect my blood sugar. So
right.
And there's an amazing baker, local baker, and this whole keto craze has been awesome because they're making all kinds of great food with really good products, with really full products, and don't affect my blood sugar. So I don't feel like I'm deprived, but I would have to say the thing I miss, I was raised in Arizona, so I'm an Arizona girl, and Mexican food is probably my favorite, so tacos and chips and salsa is probably that thing that I don't eat right now, but I do miss it. Now, I will say, if I decide I want chips and salsa, I make sure it's a thoughtful decision. And if I decide that, yes, I absolutely want this, then I just go ahead and eat it because life's too short. But I always make sure that it's a very thoughtful decision before I eat something like that.
Now, here in Texas, I mean, my gosh, Tex-Mex. My wife, okay, on our first date ever, ponchos, okay? Mexican food, it's a big part in this family. And I've got the situation with my oldest daughter, Caitlin. She pretty much about 2 hours a day every day, she's watching Pioneer Woman. Well, I don't know if you know much about Pioneer Woman, but she doesn't cook anything that's low carb.
No, she doesn't.
And well, Caitlin likes to recreate all of these dishes. And of course, well, you know, as her father, I can't say no.
That's
well,
right.
So I always have to have at least a sample, but no, it's tough. Yeah. One final question. I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you bumped into someone on the street and learned that they had just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you could only utter 6 words or less to them, what would you say?
Now you're going to make me count here. Let's see.
Hey, you're a diabetic. What's our life about? It's about counting. It's what we do. We count.
Okay, I think I have it. I think when you're diagnosed, it's so overwhelming. You want to do the right thing. You want to do everything your doctor tells you. You're programmed a little bit to, you know, like I explained in the beginning, that, you know, do these things and this will work. And I think that it takes a while for people to get their head around what is going to work for them and what is not going to work for them. And if I were to just approach somebody and say, oh, no, don't listen to them, here's what you have to do, I don't think that would work. So my 6 words would be, I'm here when you need me.
Wow. Okay. I like that. We all need to have somebody that we can turn to when times get tough, because they're going to at times. It's going to happen. It's part of it. So to tell somebody, hey, here's a resource for you. And again, I think that's got to come from part of your JDF background, because that's what you guys are. Your resource. You're all about being there for people. Vicki, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your story and your insights and letting us know just a little bit about the ups and downs of even what someone who views their current state as one that's successful, still you're able to express the fact that it's not always perfect. And I think that's the kind of thing people want to hear too. So thank you so much for being here today. I'm inspired by you, and I know that others will be too. And thank you for your hard work with JDRF. And keep doing all those great things that you're doing. Your efforts matter to a lot of people.
Well, thank you so much, Tad. And I do want to say that it's been a pleasure just getting to know you over the last few months. And I, too, am inspired by you. I think what you're doing is amazing. You know, I have the luxury of reading your book, so I think it's going to be so helpful when it comes out for so many people. So keep doing what you're doing, too.
You got it. Well, hey, thank you so much.
All right. Talk to you later, Tad.
Wow. Vicki McWaters, folks. She's an amazing person. You know, every single day, I pray to God that struggling diabetics will stay diligent long enough to discover what Vicki, myself, and so many others have, that diabetes self-management success is possible. And when that magical moment occurs, it can transform your perspective and your life and take you to levels of happiness that you never dreamed could exist. Now, I want to make one final return to the theme of this podcast, which was, if you remember the title, it was War of the Diabetes Worlds or A Celebration of Diversity. Well, I say, let's celebrate. Now, here's a quote for you. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro. I'll say that one more time. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro. That partial quote is from the beginning of Wells' War of the Worlds. The topic of human complacency was one that Wells would address in some of his other works, including The Time Machine. Looking at the industrialized and ever-growing technological world of his time, Wells was concerned that our smugness and dependence on technology would weaken us as a race. Our progress would begin to reverse as our survival skills and sharper intellect all but disappeared. Sometimes it feels that with all the technology to aid us in diabetes self-management, we are getting worse at it. We're becoming too dependent on the technology, and we're forgetting that it's just a tool. Yes, we must have insulins and meters to control our glucose levels, but we were born with the most perfect tool to manage our diabetes, our minds. We must never forget that. We must stay sharp, so that when screwy health conditions strike, we'll be ready. Guys and girls, that is it for this episode. Please make sure to subscribe at taddiabetic.com and on social media. You can also reach me through the contact form on the blog site or email tad@ataddiabetic.com. And hey, I have one assignment for you. I want you to go to www.jdrf.org. and make a donation. Give anything. Anything. I mean, because your donations fund the research, the outreach, the advancements, and the community support that representatives like Vicki McWaters build for type 1 diabetics. Go show your support. Do that for me, and I'll see you next time.